Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the farcical referendum underway in eastern Ukraine conducted by the pro-Russian secessionists who are proclaiming themselves leaders of independent republics. We will speak with Mykola Rybchuk, who is a senior research fellow at the Ukrainian Center for Cultural Studies in Kyiv and co-founder and member of the editorial board of Kritika, a leading Ukrainian intellectual magazine, about Ukraine's chances of surviving this period of destabilization by Russia and conducting an election on May the 25th that Putin appears determined to prevent. Then, with much of the world's attention focused on kidnapped Nigerian schoolgirls, we will look into a full-page ad in Sunday's New York Times blaming the South Korean president for the botched handling of the rescue attempt to free hundreds of schoolchildren from a sinking ferry and the prolonged and continuing agony of recovering bodies. Sun Yun Lee, who is a professor of international affairs at the Fletcher School of Diplomacy at Tufts University, joins us to discuss demonstrations against President Park and scrutiny of South Korea's largest public broadcasting company for its coverage of the tragedy, while investigations continue into the former cult leader turned photographer whose family owns the ferry company. Then finally, we will speak with Jeff Stein, Newsweek's intelligence correspondent, who is a Washington-based editor and investigative reporter specializing in U.S. intelligence, defense, and foreign policy, who has a weekly column in the Washington Post, Spy Talk. We will discuss his article at Newsweek, Israel Won't Stop Spying on the U.S., and look into efforts by the U.S. intelligence community to block Israel from joining the visa waiver program on the grounds that it would make it easier for Israeli spies to enter this country. And joining us now is Mykola Rybchuk, who is a senior research fellow at the Ukrainian Center for Cultural Studies in Kyiv and co-founder and member of the editorial board of Kritika, a leading Ukrainian intellectual magazine. He's a visiting fellow at the Institute of Human Sciences in Vienna, Austria. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mykola Rybchuk.
Hello.
So this election underway in the east of Ukraine, which Vladimir Putin suggested was a bad idea, but then the separatists went ahead with it, and a lot of people, including myself, think that that was a bit of theater there. But, I mean, what's happening on the ground is kind of a farce, isn't it? I mean, how can you have an election in the middle of civil unrest? And it looks as though, I mean, the same secessionists and separatists are the ones that are conducting the elections, and nobody knows whether they're really Ukrainians or you know, GRU and Spetsnaz, and the whole thing is looking like a total farce.
Absolutely, of course, it's farcical, and it cannot be qualified even in the opinion survey because, you know, it doesn't meet any criteria. Of course, it's political action. It's an attempt to show that we are the masters here and so on. But probably also it's an attempt to give some more food for Russian propaganda because, you know, it wages real propagandistic war, and they try to use any fact or semi-fact or quasi-fact to instigate, you know, tensions and to provoke some conflict. So, yeah, it's just, you know, political game.
So, in other words, this is all being done for the Russian domestic audience. It reinforces the idea that the Ukrainians in the East all want to join Russia. But I'm not sure that Putin wants the East, does he? He'd like to control and influence events in Ukraine, but I don't think he wants to pay for it, does he? He doesn't want to get stuck with the bills.
Of course. He has got already Crimea, which is a pretty heavy burden for Russian economy because they have to invest a lot of money, and expectations of people are very high there. They would certainly be disappointed. Donbass even more, even heavier burden because it's an industrialized region, but the industry was constructed mostly in the 19th century, and you know, any government would have problems with this region. So I don't think that Putin really intends to take Donbass. Crimea at least has some symbolical meaning, symbolical value for Russians, so it can be used by propaganda. But Donbass doesn't have this value. So I don't think that Putin is going to grab the region, and it would be not so easily, actually, because in the Crimea he had some local support, almost 50% of population supported secession in the Crimea. In Donbass, these figures are much lower. You know, it's like 25-30% who would like to join Russia, so it cannot be called popular support. Moreover, there is significant number of people who would like to fight, and I have some recent opinion surveys, and they say that it's almost the equal number. There are 10-12% of respondents who say that they would greet Russian troops in Donbass, but also 10-12% who say that would fight them with arms. Of course, great majority would sit on the fence. This is probably the main reason why terrorists operate relatively freely in Donbass, because most people prefer to stay at home. They don't meet many resistance. Well, the authorities try to fight them, but they very skillfully use civilians. So it's not so easy for Ukrainian forces to curb this uprising. Maybe if they use some methods as were used by Russian in Chechnya, where they didn't care about any casualties among civilians. That's another matter, but since Ukrainian government declared the European provenance, European course, so probably, of course, they should restrain themselves with European rules of game, and it's really a complicated issue, especially if you have a completely destroyed institution, destroyed military, destroyed police and security services. It's big task today to rebuild institutions.
So what do you think then is Putin's long game? Because he clearly, I think he's following Mao Zedong's dictum, which is it's better to have hegemony without responsibility. In other words, to be able to influence events in neighboring countries without being responsible to subsidize them. And he also doesn't want this May the 25th election to take place, surely, because that will legitimize his government that's very weak at the moment. But do you have a sense of, obviously it's been a tremendous boost for him in popular support, and he's been able to use that popular support to turn back the clock and take over the internet and the media, which he already controlled. But now he has complete, total propaganda control now over Russia and over the judiciary, and the opposition has all but been cowed into silence. And those that are brave enough to speak up would be arrested and languish in jail forever. So it's been really a big win for him on the domestic front, but he's nevertheless riding this tiger, isn't he?
Yes, of course, Putin would like to have Ukraine as a satellite state, something like Belarus, or preferably even like Chechnya with Kadyrov, with some tough guy who can keep everything under control and to be quite loyal to Mr. Putin, but it's very unlikely to do in Ukraine. So my feeling, my prediction is that Putin would try to sabotage any reforms in Ukraine, to keep this country in a sort of limbo, to prevent it, moving in any direction, actually moving westward. Because the main threat for Putinism is actually, European modernized democratic Ukraine. It's really deadly, maybe deadly blow for Putinism. So of course the main strategy is to keep the country on the hook, so to say, to prevent any serious investment in the country, to prevent economic reforms. I don't think that he would succeed in long run, but of course it may delay significantly Ukrainian reforms and Ukrainian development. I'm rather reluctant to use this term about legitimacy. Ukraine government is pretty legitimate because it was formed by the parliament, and parliament is quite legitimate body. It was elected 2 years ago and consists of different parties and represent different regions. And by the way, the government got more than 2/3 of support from MPs. It was supported by virtually all the factions except for the communists. So it got constitutional support in the parliament. So it's pretty you know, legitimate government. It's much more legitimate than the government in Russia, which was, you know, they don't have any free and fair elections and so on. The only problem is that, of course, we don't have a president. We have a head of the parliament who fulfills duties of the president. He's interim president, but basically he's head of the parliament. He's just a speaker of the parliament. And because of this, because of this constitutional restraints, we don't have real cabinet minister. We have only interim cabinet of minister. All of them are acting ministers. You know, that's probably the problem. But it doesn't mean that they are legitimate in any way. You know, they did not come to power by some, you know, coup d'etat, as Russian propaganda claims. Because, you know, there was revolution in Kyiv, but all this revolution was eventually channeled from the street to the parliament. And I believe this is the main success of the revolution, that it was not, you know, the power was transferred to the parliament, to legitimate body. So this is okay. And, you know, today I see in Ukraine very strong commitment of the people to hold elections within one round. I notice very strong mobilization. People understand that they should not give Putin and to give Russians any chance to sabotage elections. Because, you know, if we have second round in 3 weeks, it may be a good time for Russia to prepare some more provocations, some more, you know, subversive acts. More than 80% of Ukrainians today declare their will to vote, and probably they would vote for the leader who is leading the elections, just, you know, in order to have the president as soon as possible.
Again, I'm speaking with Mykola Rybchuk, who is a senior research fellow at the Ukrainian Center for Cultural Studies in Kyiv and co-founder and member of the editorial board of Kritika, a leading Ukrainian intellectual magazine. He's a visiting fellow at the Institute of Human Sciences in Vienna, Austria. So you've corrected me. It's not an illegitimate government in Ukraine and Kyiv so much as it's certainly a weak government. And isn't the problem that Ukraine has is that it's been so infiltrated by the Russian security people at every level, the police, the intelligence people, and that's going to be a real challenge, isn't it, for the Ukrainians to both have an election that's not sabotaged and to build a military and a police force that's not corrupt. And I guess the most important point is, which is the one I'd like you to address first, is what about these so-called fascist elements that Russia's made a lot of propaganda out of, but there are basic questions to be asked there, and a lot of people in the West are very concerned about some of these right front people. So how is that going to be handled? Because it certainly hasn't been handled so far.
Well, you know, the power of propaganda is just, you know, power, crude power. Propaganda is not built on any, you know, facts, on any arguments. It's built upon simple repetition of some the most stupid things. And if you repeat something, you know, 100 times, you know, many people would think, well, maybe it's not 100% true, but maybe 50%, maybe 5%, but still there should be. Maybe there is at least one fascist in the government. I can assure you that there is not a single fascist in Ukraine government. It's absolutely a complete lie. There are two members or three members of the radical of far-right party called Svoboda. Yes, but such parties, you know, exist in all European countries, and they are registered by the Ministry of Justice. They operate within the law, and probably you remember there was a party like this in Austria, and nothing happened. You know, Austria was not expelled from the European Union, and there was a government like this in Poland, and you remember the Kaczynski brothers. It's a huge exaggeration to call such a party, you know, fascist party. Yes, it's a nationalistic party. It's a party which is has its model is Israel. Yes, you may be surprised, but they all the time they declare that, you know, we would like Ukraine to be like Israel. They mean, you know, sort of national democracy. to preserve Ukraine character of the state, not to let it dissolve. This is only actually, you know, nationalistic, the main nationalistic feature of this party. So, but you know, it doesn't mean that it is fascist, you know. And even moreover, you know, about officials who are in the government, because they are old bureaucrats who, for various reasons, joined Svoboda Party, and they were promoted by Svoboda to the government. But you know, three persons probably do not make significant you know, influence in the government. The government consists mostly of technocratic people. Some of them are Russians, some of them are Jews, many of them are Russian-speaking, like Minister of Interior, or actually Interim President. He's a Russian-speaking Ukrainian. So, you know, I really depressed to comment all these propagandistic things. You know, it's not serious.
Well, but it is something that, of course, Russia's been beating the drum on. And to the issue of how infiltrated the police are, the police are very corrupt. I mean, isn't that the problem? You had a corrupt leadership under Yanukovych, and the earlier flirtations with the Western democracy, the leaders were equally corrupt and not quite as greedy as Yanukovych and his sons. But still, could you address that issue?
Oh, yes. Yes, you're absolutely right. Ukrainian institutions have been very weak all the time, and corruption was widespread. Not as rampant, of course, as within the past years, because it was not corruption under Yanukovych. It was state capture. It's something different. Yes, but corruption is a huge problem, and now we have, I believe, we have a very good chance to clean up the institutions. So, you know, I try to find some silver lining, some, you know, blessing under disguise in this situation, and maybe it's not so bad that Yanukovych completely destroyed all these weak institutions. So maybe there is no need to rebuild them, but just to build new institutions, especially, you know, police. So, and of course, court system needs to be reformed. I feel that Ukraine has a good chance because, first of all, we have more or less, I believe, decent people in the government. Personally, I trust the Prime Minister very much, and I hope that I don't know all of his people in the government, but probably they are like him. Also, even more important that today we have civil society which drew some lessons from past mistakes, because, you know, after the Orange Revolution, Ukrainian society relaxed too fast and did not control the government, did not force the government to fulfill promises, to deliver, And finally, I feel also that government is closely scrutinized by international donors, because the state coffers are empty. Ukraine got bailout from International Monetary Fund, which is an institution which not only borrows money but also takes care of how this money are spent and what kind of reforms are implemented. So, there is a number of factors which may force the government to carry out much needed reforms finally after, you know, 20 years of hesitation. I understand that it's too late, but, you know, better late than never.
Well, but the report's coming out now, though, that Russia's now moving towards a more economic warfare as opposed to the low-intensity destabilization of the East through the GRU and the Spetsnaz and these sort of local thugs that they've organized. How can Ukraine get around that? They owe, what, $2 billion or something to Russia already for the gas that they've used, and Russia's just going to jack up the price.
Well, first of all, it's difficult to comment all these gas issues because the situation is very murky. As you probably know, all the gas and all the energy trade between Russia and Ukraine was very, very, very murky, very nebulous. And actually, I personally have a very strong suspicion that there was double bookkeeping on both sides, and this is probably the main reason why, despite different quarrels and disputes, they never went to the Stockholm arbitrage. Neither Russia nor Ukraine never appealed to the international court. Which for me is a clear sign that they do not want to reveal their books, the documents. And so, you know, they fight, they quarrel, they, you know, discuss all these issues, but they never go to court. This is, you know, typical quarrels between two gangsters. Now I hope that situation would change, and there are very serious intentions of Ukraine government to go to Stockholm, to Stockholm court. There are many complaints on Ukrainian side because, of course, as you know, Russia uses energy as a weapon and blackmail and both pricing and implementation of different agreements are very arbitrary on the Russian side. So Ukraine has good chances to fight on this ground. But also, as you probably know, Ukraine has its own gas, which is pretty sufficient for at least for households. Well, not for industry, but for households is okay. And Ukraine has good prospects for substitution of this energy by coal, by electric energy. Ukraine is one of major exporters of electricity in Europe. But of course, the main thing, main goal for Ukraine is to diminish consumption of gas, of energy in industry, because Ukrainian industry is terribly energy consuming. So this is also what I call, you know, blessing in disguise, because Ukraine would be forced finally to implement some saving energy measures. Ukraine is not actually, you know, as poor a country as many people believe. It's a pretty rich country, and it could be self-sufficient, at least, you know, in production of food. It's also one of international exporters. At least there would be no hunger in Ukraine, this I can assure you. But of course, reforms are much needed, and of course some austerity measures are needed. But, you know, I strongly believe that even if the government manages to close all these channels through which money are stolen, budget is channeled to offshores, it would be enough to keep budget more or less balanced and to pay the bills to Russia, but at the same time to look for alternative sources of energy, alternative sources of supply.
Well, just in closing, Mykola Rabchuk, in this upcoming May the 25th elections, what are the Party of Regions, which is the party that Yanukovych belonged to, and it gets most of its support from the East, from the East where all of this phony election is taking place over this weekend, this referendum. Will the Party of Regions participate in the May 25th elections?
So far it participates, yes. They nominated their own candidate, Mr. Dobkin, from Kharkiv. And also there is a number of other candidates who could be considered as representatives of the region. Probably the most popular of them is former banker Serhiy Tyhybko. I'm really surprised why he was not nominated by the Party of Regions as a candidate, because he would have much better chances to run than Mr. Dobkin. He's much more popular. I feel that there are some, you know, internal disputes and tensions with the party. Probably Mr. Tyhybko is not as, you know, as manageable as Mr. Dobkin, and this may be the main reason why the oligarchs who finance Party of Regions prefer to bet on Dobkin, not on Tyhybko. Tyhybko is pretty self-sufficient figure. But also I see very positive developments in terms that Tyhybko is going to reestablish his own party, which was created some, you know, 5 or 6 years ago. But unfortunately, he joined the Party of Regions after Yanukovych's victory, party called Strong Ukraine. I believe, you know, such a development might be very important because this would introduce real pluralism in the eastern regions of Ukraine. Because so far we have had a pluralistic system only in central and western Ukraine, where different parties competed among themselves, but not in the southeast, where power was completely monopolized by the Party of Regions and their satellites, Communist Party, which is not actually a party, it's just simply a puppet structure. So, you know, this pluralism which would emerge in southeast of Ukraine would be very significant development, I believe, because in this case we would have more or less pluralistic system all over the country, and we would have also possibility for different coalitions in Ukraine. So we have to destroy this bipolar system, which of course contributes to various splits in Ukraine. So far as far as I know, Party of Regions is not is participating in elections and is not going to sabotage it. Probably they understand that, you know, such a move would be destructive, and such a move, of course, would be used by external forces, by Russian government to increase pressure on Russia and to also to deepen the split within the Ukraine regions and so on. So I hope that they would continue this responsible behavior.
Well, Mykhailo Rabchuk, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Mykhailo Rabchuk, who's a senior research fellow at the Ukrainian Center for Cultural Studies in Kyiv and co-founder and member of the editorial board of Kritika, a leading Ukrainian intellectual magazine. He's a visiting fellow at the Institute for Human Sciences in Vienna, Austria. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back looking into growing outrage in South Korea over the government's mishandling of the sinking of the ferry and investigations into the former cult leader turned photographer whose family owns the ferry company.